about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Frank Foster, and he'll be answering your questions on bonefish dreams. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Frank a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're enjoying the show. We'd really appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Frank Foster about bonefish dreams. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Frank, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says register for our free drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Frank's book, Bonefish Dreams, Stories, Facts, and Tips from Travels to the World's Best Destinations, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, here's how you can win Frank's book. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Frank and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage. It's the same text box you can ask questions in during the show. So listen closely. Use your best typing skills. Take notes. Pay attention. And maybe you'll be the proud owner of Frank's book, Bonefish Dreams, Stories, Facts, and Tips from Travels to the Best Destinations. Tonight, our guest is Frank Foster. Frank was chairman and CEO of one of America's fastest growing small public companies. After his company was acquired, he became a commercial real estate investor, developer, and independent venture capitalist. He enjoys life now as a published author and lives with his wife in Central Florida in the mountains of North Carolina. As he writes, fly fishes, enjoys his wine cellars, and plays golf with his treasured fence. Frank, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, hold on a second here. I have to make an adjustment. Something's not coming through on my headset here. Give me a second. Okay, let's try that now. Okay, sorry about that, Frank. Yeah, so bonefish. You recently wrote or published the book, probably took a while to write, but recently published the book, Bonefish Dreams, and you are obsessed with those bonefish. You know, for someone who hasn't fished for them, in the, you know, what makes them such a special and addictive game fish?
Well, probably the best testimonial to that fact can be found before my book even begins. As many authors do, have two, three quotations from well-known people before the first chapter. I have one from Norman McLean Tom Brokaw, Lee Wolf, but I'm sure most anglers recognize the name Lefty Cray. And here's a quotation from Lefty, the late Lefty Cray. "If I only had one day left to fish, it would have to be chasing some bonefish around a flat." That from a legend, a late legend who has cast flies probably in more countries than one can count and at more species than one perhaps know even exists. But yet, if he had one day to fish, he'd go after bonefish. And why is that? Well, probably two things come to my mind. And bone fishing to me sort of spoils one for any other kind of fishing because it's all sight fishing. You don't cast unless or until you see a fish. And the other thing is, when you do hook up, bonefish have a top end speed of, what would you guess? I'll tell you, 41 miles an hour. So
wow. Yeah.
It's never in doubt unless you catch a little dink of a pound or so, which is rare. It's never in doubt as to whether you're going to get on the reel, as it might be in trout fishing or some other. As soon as you hook up, the first task at hand is line management to make sure you're clear the line, you're on the reel, and then it's tip up and just hang on for dear life. Well, 41 miles an hour of run by a large fish takes over.
Yeah, yeah. That's exciting, right? I know for most people that have hooked one, that's really nothing like it. And also, it seems to me, you know, where you're fishing is always so pretty. You know, you're on the flats, turquoise water, hopefully not too much wind. Right?
Well, I've seen anglers, trout anglers and saltwater flats anglers almost come to blows over which fishing environment is more beautiful. And I personally prefer the flats. I just think there's nothing like it, particularly since it's a all-day pass to nature's saltwater aquarium with all these wild critters that are in vodka clear water that you can just observe at your leisure without, and until you run up on one and they spook, it's voyeuristic.
Right, right, yeah. Now, in your book, you've been all over the world fishing for bonefish. And by the way, if people don't know, Frank is donating all the proceeds, sales of his book, Bonefish Dreams, to Bonefish and Tarpon Trusts.
Let me just stop you there, if I may. I'm not donating the proceeds because I don't sell books. The publisher sells the books, and they pay me a royalty on those sales as the author. But I have committed to donate 100% of those author royalties to the conservation organization Bonefish and Tarpon Trust. And if some of your listeners are not familiar with it, it's sort of the saltwater flats equivalent of Ducks Unlimited is maybe the best way to describe it.
Yeah, yeah, help and preserve bonefish, tarpon, permit, all those flats fish. Great organization to support. So, yeah, well, thank you for doing that. And thanks for correcting me on that. So, all over, you know, around the world, you've chased these bonefish, and which you cover in your book extensively. And they're often referred to as ghosts of the flats. What should anglers understand about their behavior, and where do they get that name, ghosts of the flats?
Well, it's probably because they have a remarkable ability to blend in with the bottom, natural camouflage. And the most maddening thing about it sometimes, when you're looking and seeing a bonefish on the flat and he's not perpendicular to you, in other words, he's either coming at you or going away from you, they have a dark gray, almost black strip. It's not a strip, it's just that their back is darker in color than the sides, and so they're much easier to see. But when they turn sideways, sometimes they just simply vanish. You just can't pick them up anymore. And that's very challenging, maddening, frustrating, but in its own way, delightful.
You know, it's always a thing when you're out with the guides, whether it's bonefish or permit or whatever fish, the guides can see these fish that you can't see at all. Have you learned some, over the years of doing this again and again, tricks to seeing those fish?
Or well, the guides,
development?
The guides have the advantage of being, if you're poling, much higher than you are. They also have the advantage of being out there almost every day looking for them, and they're better at it. But as far as tricks to see them, just experience and making sure you have the best available polarized glasses that you can buy.
Yeah, yeah. What are some of the biggest misconceptions freshwater fly fishers have when they first try fly fishing for bonefish? What kind of things don't transfer over, and what are new?
Well, most of them don't realize that you can't go out there on a saltwater flat that's perfectly wide open for the most part, unless you're right up against the lee shore of a mangrove bank. And they think they can cast and fish the fish the same way as trout. And most of them are in for a rude awakening.
In what ways?
Well, a lot of trout anglers are not even familiar with the double haul, which gives you extra distance, particularly into the wind. And there's a common expression used to, unfortunately too often, by bonefish guides with trout anglers who are trying to make the transition. You know, a guide is always barking orders to the angler. Some of them bark, some of them just say it gently. But a trout angler hears this too often: no trout set.
Right, yeah.
You know, barked at them, because in any saltwater fishing, almost any that I know of, the hook set is done with a strip, with the rod continued to be down, you know, to be parallel with the water surface. Whereas, as you know, I'm sure, with a trout fishing, the first thing you do when you get a take is you lift the rod. Depending on the circumstance, you may lift it sharply if it's the trout has taken the nymph, you know, and perhaps the strike indicator's disappeared, or a dry fly that's above the nymph, and you strike very quickly and savagely. On the other hand, you know, a trout that comes up and is sipping dry flies, the old expression is, you say, God save the queen, before you somewhat gently lift the rod and the fish is on. Well, if you lift the rod after a bonefish takes your fly, it's game over.
Is that primarily due to the toughness of the saltwater fish, their mouths and so forth, to try to get that hook set in there?
Well, no, it's just physics, really. Bonefish are bottom feeders. They spend their whole lives with their nose digging in dirt, essentially, the bottom. And when you peel something and lift the rod or trout set, it just pulls the fly right out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I just had a question come in here on the internet. Treg and Owens in Moscow, Idaho, is asking, what color of lens do you prefer for your polarized glasses?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I've used amber for a long time, and recently Costa Del Mar came out with a mirrored lens. It's not one of those where you can, you know, look in somebody else wearing them and shave your face or comb your hair. It's not like that, but it's kind of a new technology they have, and I've been wearing those on bright days. On days where unfortunately the sky is not kind to bonefish anglers, where you're socked in all day, wear yellow lenses, just like I do always when I trout fish. The yellow lens, even on a very cloudy day, gives you a raised image as you look through the water that you won't get with a darker shade of lens.
Are these new lenses, these mirrored ones, are those amber or yellow as well, or?
Yeah, they're sort of amber, but I mean, they call them the mirrored lens, and I apologize for not being able to be more descriptive of the shade they are, the color that they are, but they're more amber than they are, certainly more amber than they are. As I said, a woman couldn't look in them, somebody's wearing them, put her lipstick on, let's put it that way.
Right, right, yeah. And after 4 decades of chasing, I think it's been 4 decades you have chased bonefish, is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. What have you learned about the fish that surprised you most?
Well, one thing is you say surprised, let me just modify that to say that's most interesting to me.
Sure.
A couple of things, and one I've already described it, and that's the color change they can adopt, depending on which direction they're facing or heading, and also the bottom. They tend to, just like redfish do and snook, take on the color of their habitat. You know, if you catch a bonefish or a redfish or a snook way in the backcountry, they'll be darker in color. Fish that are very close to the ocean tend to be much lighter, whiter, more silver in color. But the other thing that's fascinating about a bonefish have, and a lot of people don't know this, they have windshields. I'm calling it a windshield. They have a windshield on each eye. I can't tell you what the tissue is that it's made from, but if you gently hold a bonefish prior to releasing it and reach down with your finger, with the fish still in the water now for conservation practices, and touch his eye, you will not be able to find an eyeball because they have a windshield on each eyeball. It's completely covered. There's no way you could poke the eyeball out of a bonefish. You'd have to get him in the boat. If you wanted to hold his eyeball, you'd have to carve it out of his face. And
is that something that comes down like an eyelid, or is it always over?
No, it's not a lid. They don't have eyelids. It's like a windshield. It's a clear
covering, cover. Huh? Yeah.
It goes over their eye, just like a windshield. It's the best term I can come up with. And it's something that God equipped these bonefish with because of the way they feed. They spend most of their lives with their head stuck in the dirt, in the bottom, the sandy bottom of a flat. And so without this, I mean, think about if you did that, the term, I have something in my eye, would be the understatement of the century.
Right.
You know, it'd be a bunch of sand, but they don't have that problem. Because the shield, they can continue to grub on the sandy bottom and still see their prey without, quote, getting something in their eye.
Right, right.
I find that just really a fascinating quirk of nature.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me when I was a kid, we drove from Chicago. My family drove from Chicago to Anchorage, Alaska, because my dad was getting stationed there. We drove up Dalkin Highway, and my dad had, I think it was a 1960 Mercury sedan, and he put on these bubbles on the headlights, these plastic coverings to protect the headlights because, you know, the Alpine Highway was all gravel back then. And sure enough, you know, you'd lose a headlight or two on the way up there. But that reminds me of those bubbles, I guess. Covering the protection.
Yeah, that's why I would, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come right back and we'll dig deeper into talking about bonefish. So hang tight, everybody, and we'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com, or you could call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com, or call them at 866-845-9284. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Frank Foster about bonefish dreams. If you'd like to ask Frank a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. So, Frank, at this point in the show, I always ask, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Tell us about what you're up to. I know publishing your book is a big event and a lot of hard work. So tell us what you're up to now.
Well, I have one more signing left, actually two, on July 10th, Friday at 5:30 p.m. I'll be speaking and signing books at Brookings Outfitters in Cashers, North Carolina. Cashers is the way it's pronounced. Phonetically, it's spelled Cashiers. Brookings is a massive outfitter store and wonderful fly shop. And so if anybody's in the area, July 10th, Friday, 5:30 p.m., Brookings has their famous Blue Line Bar. Yeah, I assume you know where the Blue Line came from.
Right.
You know, when you look at trout streams, the Blue Line, right?
Right, the maps, yeah.
Yeah, so, and Brookings is kindly offering the first beverage from their bar, the Blue Line Bar, with their compliments. So if anybody's in the area, I'd love to see them for that. I have another standing up in Linville, North Carolina, that I was invited to speak to a book club. So that's a private affair for members of the book club and their guests. But you ask what I'm up to in this particular area, and that's a couple of things.
Frank, do you have a website for your book?
I do, and it's www.frankfosterbonefishdreams.com. FrankFosterBonefishDreams.com.
People can connect with you there.
I'd love to hear from anybody.
Sure. Great. Yeah, and we do have a link to your book on the front page of our website there, so if anybody's interested in ordering a book, you can do that there, or I'm sure directly with Frank. If you want an autographed copy, then that's the way to go. Well, great. Any bonefish trips planned in the near future?
I've always got a bonefish trip, and I shouldn't use the singular. It's
trips,
always ones.
Where are you headed to?
Well, the next two that are on the books are to Little Abaco and Grand Bahama.
Ah, okay. That's good bonefish country, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the best, right? Yeah. Well, let's dive back into our questions, talk more about bonefish. What are environmental factors that influence where bonefish will be found on a given day, and how do you read those factors and convert them into success?
Well, I would say three things: tide, tide, and tide. It's all about the tides.
All about the tides.
Yeah.
Incoming tides.
Because bonefish come onto a flat based on what the water's doing, whether it's rising or falling, and in what stage of a tide it's in. And there's some secondary issues like the water clarity and so forth, but the main thing is the tide.
And I'm sure that fluctuates around the world as how big that tide is and, you know, how much water is on the flat. Or is that something that's fairly consistent?
Well, no, it's there are two things that are always moving. One is bonefish, because they're always on the move. They never just sit there, for example, like a trout will in their feeding station, while an angler can be stationary with them and present, you know, up to a dozen different flies to them trying to get them to eat one. Bonefish are always moving looking, well, mainly moving, looking for food, but also moving if they're just in transit from point A to point B for whatever reason. And so depending on whether the, on low tide, for example, a lot of people think bonefish are a little more nervous because they want to feed as long as they can, but make sure they get off the flat before the water gets too skinny and they may be more exposed to predators. When the water falls, the bonefish tend to, at the end of the tide phase on low water, drop off the flat into deeper water, regroup and wait for the tide to turn, and when it floods back on that flat, they go with it and are actually a little more comfortable on a rising tide because they know they're all, there's plenty of time to have plenty of water available to them. Any of that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. Did they know where the bonefish go when they get off the flat? Are they hanging
just
off the
reef?
Yeah,
just into deeper water, they're, you know, pools, the channels, little finger channels or big channels. They just drop off the flat and wait for the water to come back where they can feed on the little critters that live on those skinny water flats.
Right, yeah. Phil McCartney in Kentucky wrote in and he says, how do you feel about fly fishing for carp? It's, is referring to them as freshwater bonefish more than a marketing plan of the carp's publicist came up with? But a lot of people refer to them as freshwater bonefish because you may fish for them similarly. Have you fished for carp? Is it similar?
All I can say is I'm aware of what you're talking about, but I've never done it.
Oh, okay.
I think there's two kinds of carp, if I'm not mistaken. I've never fooled with either one of them, to be perfectly frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know out here in the west, up in Wyoming, they some guys even have flats boats, and they go out in the lakes and hunting for carp in a similar fashion of bonefish. Anyway, yeah, anyway, that's something out there. There's another environmental weather question. I guess it's winter in New York. Says, when fishing for bonefish, tarpon permit, and you can't get a full or new moon week at the lodge, does it matter that much in your opinion? Is the fishing that poor? Do you find another lodge to get a prime week or skip a year?
How important is that moon? What do you do if you can't get a booking on a full or a new moon?
Right.
Okay. Well, I never book on the full or the new moon anyway.
That's when you don't want to book. Yep.
That's my opinion.
Yeah. And yeah.
Full and the new moon are the tides around those big moons are called spring tides because the high tides are substantially higher and the lows are substantially lower. And the problem with that are those high tides because the bonefish get way back up in the mangroves. You can't get at them. And you have all you reduced to sitting there and waiting for the water to fall so they'll come out. On the opposite of a spring tide, in other words, tides around quarter moons, are called neap tides, N-E-A-P, and I prefer those because it's much easier to get more hours of low water during a bone fishing day, and low water is, generally speaking, what you want for bonefish because they can't go way up in the mangroves and hide from you.
Okay, yeah, that's what I always understood and for fishing for tarpon and also permit, that the full moon is not ideal. That was my understanding as well. Talk about reading water and finding fish. What types of flats are most productive for bonefish and how can anglers recognize them?
Well, all flats are so similar, but if you can fish flats that are near a creek or moving water, you're better off, particularly near creeks, because particularly on falling water, the outgoing tide brings food out of, for bonefish, out of the creek and onto the flat.
Mm-hmm. So those are more ideal? What about, I mean, what about the bottom structure? You know, gravel, mud, you know, is there anything you're looking for there?
Those critters that they're after are on all kinds of bottoms.
Okay.
And, of course, from an angler standpoint, so a smooth, pure white sand bottom is a dream because you can see the fish from long distances, and if you're wading, you don't have to worry about stepping in a hole or tripping over a rock on the bottom.
Right. Okay. What about distinguishing, I mean, we always want to fish the fish that are eating, right? So how do you distinguish the feeding fish from a cruising fish? And do you tend to, you know, are you still casting to cruising fish, or you just ignore them and look for feeding fish? How does that all work?
Well, a term that is probably more associated with tarpon fishing is the word happy. What you want to look for is happy fish, and that means just what you asked, a feeding fish. The faster a fish is going, the less happy, the less chance he's feeding and looking for something that's going to look like your fly. Now, that doesn't mean you don't cast to it. You know, if you, I mean, you don't go out of your way to cast to it or them if it's a school. But ideally, fish that are, well, the ultimate is one that is not moving and is tailing. You know, grubbing on the bottom in one spot, he's found a nice little bucket of stew or whatever, so to speak, and he stays in one place and you see his tail wagging in the air. And then from there, just slowly cruising, meandering fish are the ones that are happy and looking for something to eat on the bottom. And then it goes down from there to the ones that are sort of zooming by. Your percentage goes way down there.
Right, right.
In November, you see a lot of migrating fish that are actually going from point A to point B. This is mostly in November. And a lot of people, and they will eat. You know, they're usually in schools. You put the fly away out in front of them. And some people like that. I don't personally consider that a particularly satisfying angling experience. Some people who don't do it very often or less experienced will go down there just for that, because they know they'll get a lot of hookups. They're in for, they're out for quantity rather than quality.
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that. And when you say November, are you talking about
in the
Central America? Oh, in the Bahamas.
In the Bahamas, okay. November is migrating fish month, typically.
Okay. Do you consider the Bahamas one of the best places in the Caribbean that for bonefish?
I do, and particularly since the bonefish some years ago left the Florida Keys, and as everybody probably knows, they're making a big comeback there, which is wonderful. But in that period when they weren't in the Keys to speak of, the Bahamas sort of took over, and it's my go-to location.
Yeah. Okay. I know that they have the larger bonefish there than like in Belize and so forth. Is that, do you know what causes that?
You say larger fish in Belize? Is that what you're
saying? No, in the Bahamas than in Belize.
Oh, yes.
Do you know what causes that? Why they don't grow bigger in Belize? Is it food source? Is it different species or variant?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just got back from Belize, and I can confirm for you that the bonefish are small.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were mainly after permit and tarpon.
Where were you in Belize?
But they're still there, and they're still small.
What part of Belize were you in fishing?
I went to a wonderful lodge called Turnip Flats.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, in the northern part, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Very nice people run that place.
Yeah.
And own it.
Yeah. Beautiful location. When you're hunting bonefish, how close can you realistically get before spooking them? Are they spooky fish in general?
The degree of spookiness of bonefish, whether it's a single or schools or singles and doubles or schools, is extremely variable. And I don't know of anybody who knows why some are and some aren't. The conditions have a big part to play. When it's windy, there's a chop on the water, it's much easier to get closer to a bonefish because their ability to see and hear you is diminished. But when it's slick, calm, and bright and sunny, very difficult to get very close to them because they can hear you and they can see you so easily. And the slightest little movement or noise that gets transmitted through the water will put them off. But in any given conditions, there's great variation in the degree of spookiness in any day of fishing. Some days, they'll just be seemingly oblivious to everything but your fly and pounce on it. Other days, the slightest little disturbance that you might make or the just a very light beefhead fly landing terrifies them. They run from it like they saw a ghost. And it's unpredictable, totally. I've had fish follow the fly that I'm stripping and eat it a rod's length from the boat. And I've had other fish that I've had to cast 80 feet to, and they're terrified.
Interesting, yeah. So, sounds like if you're going for bonefish, you better be ready to make your casts, because you could be making long casts, right? I mean, that's
and
probably
you better be quiet, too.
Better, I'm sorry?
And you'd better be ready to be quiet.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the next question is what have guides taught you about being stealthy, things to do, not to do?
Well, if you're on the, I see anglers that insist on wearing shoes when they're on the casting platform. And shoes, I don't care what kind they are, even sneakers, I guess the term is supposed to mean they're quiet. They're not. They make noise. And you know, a cooler, lid to a cooler, dropping something, anything on the in the deck of the skiff transmits that noise. Now, the chief scientist at Bonefish Tarpon Trust, Aaron Adams, brilliant man, very nice guy too, told me in an interview for my book that they cannot hear you talk. But I swear I have had bonefish. I can remember one instance in particular when I presented a fly to a single large bonefish and the guide said, "Strip!" And that fish just bolted off. So the last thing I'd ever do is disagree with the eminent scientists. But all I know is that when you're on the casting platform, the bow of the skiff, or when you're waiting, and waiting in particular, you have to just creep up on those fish very gently. And even then, they somehow know you're there. They sense your presence. So stealth and being quiet is paramount.
Right. Well, time to take another quick break here, Frank. Hang tight. We'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PureSkagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PureSkagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Frank Foster about bonefish dreams. If you'd like to ask Frank a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that form. Send it our way, and we'll get your questions answered. Okay, let's see. Okay, a question came in here on the Internet, Frank. Phil in Kentucky says, I've read stories about reels exploding from friction when a hooked bonefish takes off running. Have you had any equipment fail when a hooked bonefish decides to leave the area?
I have not. Years ago, when I first got into fly fishing, I had a couple of reels smoked by a tarpon and had to throw them away and start over. But the reels, if you go to any reputable fly shop and say, I want a reel for bone fishing, you're not going to have to worry about what your listener asked. They're all now of incredible quality, and I've had a bonefish reel get cooked, and frankly, I've never heard about anybody that did. The only way I can think of that would happen would be if somebody made the mistake of taking a trout reel out on the bonefish flat.
Yeah, most of those saltwater reels are very well made nowadays.
Yeah, and so many people forget to or get real lax about even hosing them off. They're maintenance free.
Yeah.
And they just keep on working. They're astonishing, really.
Yeah, one thing I learned is you want to make sure you go to the flats with a large arbor reel, too.
I was going to say that. the first reels I had were the Billy Pate reels by, what's his name, Bill? Ted Jurassic. And they were anything but large arbor, but all my reels, I still have a few of those, but all my reels now are large arbor, and they seem to be getting, the arbor seem to be getting larger, if anything.
But, sure helps taking up that line.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful advantage when you're cranking on a nice big bonefish.
Right, right. Yeah, or a tarpon, or a permit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, since we've kind of migrated over to equipment, what's your standard rod, reel, fly line setup for bonefish? Is it something that you settled on, or do you have different rigs? And what
well,
do you prefer?
I guess, if somebody said to me, well, I'm going to get in this bone fishing, but I don't want to buy a closet full of rods. I'm going to buy one. So I would say a 9-foot, 8-weight with a large arbor reel and weight forward bonefish taper fly line, and you'll be in business.
Yeah. Or just about anywhere in the world, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And what about leader? What do you use for leader, and how long are your leaders?
Well, currently I'm using 12-foot leaders that are 16-pound test at the tippet, but 50-pound test at the butt section and tapered from there, from the 50-pound down to the 16-pound, and I tie on 16-pound tippet after a certain number of fly changes.
Okay.
I start with a 12-foot leader, but it doesn't take very long for it to get a lot shorter than that.
Yeah.
I mean, with fly changes, it's not realistic to assume that one that starts with a 12-foot leader will be fishing all day with a 12-foot leader. More likely, you'll be fishing closer to 10 or 11 foot.
Right.
If it's windy, sometimes I will, before I start the day, snip off 6, 8, or 12 inches of the tippet to shorten the leader to start with.
And why is that?
If it's windy.
Oh, so if it's windy. Okay.
It'll make the shorter the leader, the easier it is to get the leader to turn over.
And punch through the wind, yeah, with the fly, yeah. Right? Yeah, okay. What about fly patterns? Are there any universal patterns that you've used all over the world that seem to work everywhere? Does each place have its own unique selection that you go to, depending on the guides?
Well, just about anywhere in the Bahamas, the standard issue bonefish flies will work fine. There are some remote places where I'm trying to remember in the Seychelles what the guides suggested, but I can't remember, to be perfectly honest with you. But I will tell you that I would say if you had to put one fly in your box, you were told that's all you could have, probably the gotcha is the universally accepted fly by bonefish worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
I use plenty of other flies, like the mantis shrimp pattern, the gotcha clouser, Enrico Puglisi's spawning shrimp. You know, pick up any catalog and, you know, there are endless patterns, it seems.
Right, yeah. Yeah, primarily representing crabs and shrimp for the most part, right?
Right. Although yeah. I have a now dearly departed friend I used to fish with, former board member of Bonefish Starving Trust, and he would tie on nothing but a crab pattern. Fish with it all day. Catch bonefish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And I know guides and who will tell you it doesn't make a bit of difference what fly you tie on. They're probably going to eat it.
If it's presented properly.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, we were out on a pancake flat in Belize and kind of taking a break, and I just started turning over rocks out there, coral, to look underneath and find crabs. And it seemed like none of those crabs were the same color. Like everyone had a unique color. Some were brown, some were greenish. And what that told me is, if that's representative, I mean, I'm looking at all these things, that's what the fish are seeing too. And it's more about presentation than it would seem than the color of the crab, which some people get really picky about. But
you
man,
were
it
pretending
seemed like,
you were on a trout stream checking out the entomology, even though you're on the flats. That's neat. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, but they were all different colors. I was surprised. I thought, oh, well, they'll all be brown, or they'll all be green, or they'll all be, you know, in between. But no, they're all different. So that, it just made me think about, I think sometimes we put too much emphasis on the flies and not so, and we should be looking more at our presentation than anything else. I know there's a lot of trout anglers that would say the same thing about trout. It's like, it's not so much the fly, it's the presentation, because these fish are always eating something. They have to. it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner all the time, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, right.
To live.
In fact, in my book, I quote my friend Chico Fernandez, that he wrote in his book. He sometimes will change the size of the fly and not the color to entice a take.
How much of that do you think is more for the angler than for the fish?
Good question.
yeah. Sometimes it's, you know, we always talk about confidence, right? You got to be confident in your fly.
Right.
And so, you know, it all plays a role, I guess, one way or the other. It works itself together. Jason Stacy in Kentucky wrote in and said, what flies and what size would you recommend to somebody if they plan to do a do-it-yourself bonefish trip? Would they be the ones you just mentioned, the gotcha, the Puglisi spawning shrimp, things like that?
Yes, and probably number four hook and bead eye, and because ideally what you're looking for is fish in low water. So if you're successful in anticipating which tide you'll be fishing to try to have low water to fish most of the day, you know, you don't want to be charging out there with a number two lead eye gotcha or something like that, which sounds like to a bonefish that you land at a hardware store next to them.
How do you decide when to fish a heavier fly versus a lighter fly?
Just the depth of the water, and okay. Also the, you know, the deeper the water, the heavier the fly, because the, you know, bonefish are always on the move, so you have to make your cast to a spot that you want the fly to land to anticipate where the fish is going to move to, and problem with fishing too light a fly in deeper water is by the time it finally sinks, the bonefish may have moved out of the range that you thought he was going to be in. So it's important to have a fly that sinks rapidly enough to get down to the bottom where the bonefish are looking for food, but not be so heavy as to risk spooking them because of some big thing that landed in the water and made a big noise and terrified them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had a follow-up question coming here from Stephen Sykes in Silver Springs, Maryland. It says, on leaders, I assume you're using fluorocarbon leaders since the fish are on the bottom when feeding. Is that the case? And
I have
also
used
a
lot of, you know, I'm actually using fluorocarbon now, but for years I used pre-tapered 12-foot, 12-pound test leaders from Cortland and did very well with them. It said that fluorocarbon will sink a little faster, and that's good, but in my heart of hearts, I'm not sure there's a material difference, only very subtle ones.
Yeah. He also asked if you ever use intermediate lines.
Intermediate sink? For tarpon, yes.
Not for bonefish?
No.
Okay. There are more leader questions coming here. Treg says, do you use a bimini twist anywhere in your leader? If not, what knot do you use to go from 50 pound to the next piece of leader?
Blood knots,
yeah.
Surgeon knots, fine. Bimini twist, I don't think I've ever seen a bimini twist in a bonefish leader system. Plenty of them used in tarpon leader systems.
Another question in on the internet. Treg asks, at Christmas Island, the guides did not like the rubber legs on my flies. How do you feel about that?
rubber legs, often called silly legs. I'm a fan of them. I have encountered a very few guides who don't seem to like them. Had one guide grab my fly one time and took his pliers out and cut them off. you know, which, I mean, it would... I didn't say anything. I was fine with it. He's a guide.
Yeah.
You know, the old expression, don't guide the guide.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And I think they ate it. So it goes back to what you hear often. Some of these things, it probably doesn't make much difference one way or the other.
I mean, it gives a lot of movement, you know. I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, I had some unique experiences with Pat's rubber legs flies down in Patagonia fishing for trout, but stripping in the lake, you know, and the guy says, yeah, strip it, see what happens. Sure enough, he says, they don't know what it is, but it looks like it's alive and moving and they're going to hit it. Sure enough. You know, a lot talks about that, and the, you know, Puglisi uses a lot of this kind of translucent materials and stuff on his flies. And I think that gives it more lifelike look and action. And I think there's a lot to that in the way of flies, whether it's bonefish or trout or permit or whatever. But, yeah, what separates consistently successful bonefish anglers from those who struggle? What do they do different or the same all the time?
Well, just, you know, the two basic things, casting and stripping. I mean, you have to be able to present the fly in a way that removes all suspicion on the part of the bonefish and keeps them at ease. And then you have to strip it in a way that does the same thing, where it looks natural to him. I see anglers where they're stripping, they don't put much thought into their stripping technique. You have to imagine what that little thing looks like, little critter that a bonefish is chasing, looks like on the bottom. And the reason you strip is to make it hop along the bottom like they do. And some guys, they cast and lay the fly down, drop it, and immediately start furiously stripping and end up scaring the you-know-what out of the bonefish, and they bolt off.
Well, let me present a scenario to you. You're on the bow of the boat. The guide says, fish at 2 o'clock moving left, feeding as they go. What do you do?
Well, the ideal first thing to happen is for the angler to see the fish. That's always ideal, but it doesn't always happen. And then you get into directional casting. That's a term that means the guide directs your casting verbally. If it's apparent you can't see the fish, then he takes over and says, give me a cast. If that fish is at 2 o'clock moving toward noon, he'll probably say, give me a cast at noon 50 feet. And so you start making false casts, and the guide will typically say, more left, or more right, a little more distance. And when he's satisfied or hopes that the airborne fly is in the right place, the best place, he'll say, okay, drop it. And then that becomes your final cast after the false cast. And you hope for the best. Is that the answer you were looking for?
Yeah. Now what happens? The fly hits the water, and what do you do next?
Well, assuming that the angler still can't see the fish, then the guide then takes over and directs the stripping operation. He may say, depending on where the fly has landed, let's say it's landed a little further from the fish than the angler or the guide, if he were fishing, would have put it if the angler saw the fish and the bonefish hadn't had a chance to get there yet. He might say, okay, let it sit a minute. And then when the fish comes in range of the fly, then he'll say, strip, strip. And a lot of times he'll say, strip, 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 stop. And the reason he says that is when a bonefish is chasing these little critters that are hopping along the bottom trying to get away from the bonefish, a lot of times they will stop and try to burrow down in the sand and hide. It rarely works for them, but that's why he says stop, to try to imitate what those little critters do. And so typically he might say strip, 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 stop. And then for beginning anglers, he'll say, long strip. And that's a metaphor for strike the fish with a strip strike. And he uses that with inexperienced anglers because if you tell a trout angler who's new to bone fishing, okay, he's got it. You know, next thing that rod comes up in the air and a trout lose the fish.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. No, that's a good description of how it all happens. And when we're talking about stripping, are these 6-inch strips, 12-inch strips, 2-foot
strips? It's a rather personal thing, I find. There are a lot of guides that say long and slow. Give me long, slow strips. I mostly try to fish for bigger fish, and I find that long strips have the possibility of spooking a large fish. I have found that if you present a fly to a large fish, less is more as far as stripping is concerned. That you just barely sort of move it and you have a better chance of not spooking them and of getting a take.
Okay, good tip. The you know, let's say you're a newbie to this and you get out there and you're lucky enough to get that first take, do your strip set, get hooked up. What are beginning bonefish anglers expect during their first bonefish run, and how do you handle that run?
Well, the first thing that beginning bonefish anglers need to deal with is line management. And the less experienced the bonefish angler is, the more issues and catastrophes they have with losing fish because they didn't clear the line properly. The line got, when clearing, got wrapped around the butt of the rod and broke the fish off and so forth. Or, I mean, the first time I went a bone fishing with a fly rod as opposed to catching them on spinning gear, I broke off the first two or three fish I hooked because I was new to fly fishing. I didn't understand yet fully the extent to which your left hand becomes the reel, so to speak, and you have to let the line go. So those are things I think beginning fly fishing anglers have to deal with.
Yeah. You know, you talked earlier about not wearing shoes.
Yeah.
So the other thing about that that I found is that if you're not wearing shoes, you can feel that line under your foot if it's under your foot, where if you're wearing shoes, a lot of times you don't know if you're standing on your line or not.
Very good. You put your finger on the other main reason that fishing barefoot is advised.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, I mean, I don't know. I found that invaluable to be able to feel what's going on down there.
No question.
Yeah. Yeah. Phil in Kentucky wrote in here on the internet. He says, please tell us about the first bonefish you ever caught, since you just mentioned it. Do you remember that catch?
Well, I do, and in fact, it's in the book, Bonefish Dreams, my story, my first one. And it was at Chub Key, and we were down there. I was down there with a friend of mine on his sport fish, and we were marlin fishing. And I'd always read in Florida Sportsman about this bonefish thing, but I'd never seen a bonefish, never caught one. Didn't know anything about them, how to fish for them. So we asked around if there was a bonefish guide. Sure enough, there was. And way back then, his skiff was nothing you'd want to see in a boat show or anything, but kind of very basic. Had no poling platform. That was before they came along. And his push pole was a piece of red pine he chiseled out. And he had some spinning rods that were, shall we say, not exactly factory fresh. And off we went. And wasn't that easy to get shrimp those days in the Bahamas. So he had some conch that he mutilated with his teeth and put that on the hook, and that was the bait. And that was my first bonefish. It was about a 7-pounder.
Wow, that's a good
and
start.
It wasn't a fly rod, but
yeah.
But you know, even a spinning rod gets in a big curve, and
yeah,
and that reel sings, and right then and there, I was addicted.
Yeah, yeah, cool. What are some other keys to fighting large bonefish without losing them, and what mistakes do most anglers make when fighting bonefish?
Well, there are two schools of thought on drag setting. I personally think it's that a slightly looser drag increases your odds. Another thing is, you know, the trout fishing, you know, raise that rod, get that tip way up. We have to get the tip up. And the other thing is, so much of the bottom of these bonefish flats are rocky, and so it's, you'll see pictures of anglers, and I don't know how much you've done it yourself, but holding their rod way up above their head, almost like a referee signaling touchdown, except his hands are together holding the rod. And the reason for that is to try to get the greatest, sharpest angle between the running fish with the fly in his mouth and the hazards on the bottom. In other words, if you sort of fought it sidearm, you'd have a much greater risk of the bonefish. What happens, they don't break you off. They just use these rocks or the rocky bottom or a piece of coral or anything, you know, on the bottom to rub the fly out of their mouth. It's ingenious, really. They're quite accomplished at it, much to my chagrin, more often than I'd like to admit.
Yeah. And I remember these little small mangroves that they seem to like to wrap around.
I mean, that's the other thing. They're maddening how they'll find a mangrove or even a stick up out away from the shore. You know,
right.
They wrap the leader around. It just drives you crazy.
Yeah. I remember Pete Parker, who's passed away quite a few years ago, big saltwater guy from way back, and he always say, get down and dirty with them, any of these saltwater fish.
Well, down and dirty is the phrase that Billy Pate invented with his world record tarpon fishing. That's down and dirty, and I will go down and dirty on a bonefish, but only, and as you would any fish, really, including tarpon, only in very close quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you pull in the direction away from the path of the fish that he's trying to fight you and make another run, that tires them out very quickly.
Yeah.
This is only
yeah.
close quarters.
Yeah, okay.
You're just spinning your wheels trying to go down and dirty if the fish is still way out there.
Mm-hmm. You fished many of the world's premier bonefish destinations. What factors should anglers consider when choosing their first bonefish trip?
Well, a beginner for their first trip, do some homework and pick a lodge, a fishery that has lots of fish and ones that are always friendly.
That's a big ask.
I think a prime example of that is the marls of Abaco. And there are lodges and that fish the marls. The marls are due west of Great Abaco, very large fishery, and the fish are always there. They're always friendly. And what some people maybe don't like about it as much, more experienced anglers, is they're always small. Now, I shouldn't say that, because I've caught 6 and 7 pound fish in the marls. But by and large, if you want to concentrate on pure quality instead of quantity, that would not be the choice. But a beginner who needs to develop, you know, his casting, his stripping technique, and how to fight and land a fish, some place like that would be ideal, in my opinion.
Phil in Kentucky wrote in here and said, ask, what are some places in Florida for a beginner to attempt to catch a bonefish?
I would say, well, really, I mean, the Keys, because that's the only place they are. And you could, I mean, the Florida Keys and Biscayne Bay are the only Florida bone fisheries, so to speak. They have now occasionally found a bonefish or two. It must have taken a wrong turn at the channel marker or something and ends up in Tampa Bay. And there's some, I think, as far north as maybe Vero Beach or something, but just an oddity. But from Biscayne Bay, which used to be a wonderful fishery and is coming back strong, and the same goes for the Keys, there are times of year that a beginner could go to, let's say, the Middle Keys, and when kind of the end of the season, when into June, July, when you find not big fish on the flats, because the bigger fish, it's too hot for them, they drop off into deeper water, but the smaller fish are still up on the flats in good numbers and very easy to catch. So that would be another beginner location, possibly.
Okay. One final question, or hold on, two questions. Richard in New Jersey wrote in and said, have you noticed marked changes in the weather patterns affecting flats fishing in the Caribbean, especially January, February, and March? Which months do you prefer?
Well, there was a fellow whose name escapes me who wrote a book many years ago about bone fishing when I first started to get involved with it, and he said the best months to go are May and November. And I still go in November, but I no longer go in May because in May the meteorologists call it a Bermuda high. Big high pressure so often is sitting out in the Atlantic and just funneling winds from the southeast. And finally dawned on me after a few years. And May is a good time to go tarpon fishing, so I stopped going in May, and then I finally also realized that down in the Bahamas, as opposed to Central Florida where I live, the water temperature and the air temperature in the winter months, you know, like February, March, and so forth, are quite amenable to anglers and particularly to bonefish, because when the water's cooler on the flats is when the big fish come up on the flats. And so I started going. Now I go in November, occasionally early December, but rarely. Christmas is always an issue. And sometimes late January, but definitely February, March, and April are probably the 3 months, along with November, that I mostly go.
Okay. One final question. You've experienced fishing in some of the world's most famous destinations. If an angler could take only one bonefish trip in their lifetime, where would you send them, and what would make that destination unforgettable?
Well, I assume you mean an experienced angler, because I think I've already answered the question as far as a novice.
Yes,
an experienced angler, I would say to go to a place you can't go to anymore. That's Chub Key in the Barrie Islands. Now, you can go to it. The only problem is they went private and started out at $50,000 initiation fee. It's gone to $100,000. Started out at $5,000 a year dues. It's gone to $10,000. But it's a beautiful facility there. And it is always, in my opinion, had the largest bonefish in the Bahamas, more so than Andros, which everybody else besides me, I think, you agree, has the largest fish. To me, Chub Key, which is in the Barrie Islands, had the largest fish. You can still fish it if you have using a mothership approach, and get the guides to come out, which they will do. But at Chub, I mean, a 6-pound fish is just ho-hum. Because so many of them, you know, are 7, 8, 9, and that's, it's wow. The only place I've caught double-digit fish, frankly.
Wow, nice.
Andros, I've caught plenty of 8, 9 pounders pumping up against double-digit. But so anyway, that would be my answer.
Okay. Well, it's time to wrap things up here, Frank. We're running out of time. I told you to go by fast.
Yeah.
Lots to talk about.
It's been a lot of fun for me.
Yeah. We're going to be... Stick with me here for just a couple more minutes. We're going to give away membership to Fly Fishers International and one to Trout Unlimited, and we'll also be giving away your book, Bonefish Dreams, Stories, Facts, and Tips from Travels to the World's Best Destinations, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So let's just take a minute, and Frank, tell us about your book, why you wrote it, what you feel you achieved with the book, and why people should read it.
Well, I'll tell you. I'll read you the first paragraph of the book. Are you okay with that?
Sure.
Because it answers the question pretty well. Chapter 1, The Bonefish and the Martini. I'm a sick man. Want proof? Well, I get about 50 days a year of guided fly fishing, go to the Bahamas 4 or 5 times a year chasing bonefish, and I fly fished in 17 different countries. Instead of relying on an inheritance, my kids are going to have to get jobs. Actually, they have wonderful careers and are a blessing in my life, but I think they're watching me pretty closely. So anyway, as you can see from that, my life is sort of one big fishing trip.
And, yeah.
And my buddies, you know, I've had four novels published, and my buddies finally got on me and they said, why don't you write a book about this stuff? You know, get off your you-know-what and do it. So I did.
And there it is. Huh? Very good. Very good. All right. Well, hang tight here, and we'll be right back. We'll give that one of those books away here tonight. Stick with me just a couple more minutes.
All righty.
The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you won't miss out on a chance to win one of these great prizes. So if you are one of the lucky winners, contact me after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. First thing we'll do is give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And that, let me see here. Let me check something. Looks like our winner is, I'm trying to see where he comes from. Mark Billow. And he comes from Ohio. Mark Billow in Ohio. So congratulations, Mark. And I know you'll enjoy your membership to Fly Fishers International. And if you aren't a member, you know, join today anyway. Great organization to support. Same with TU. Our winner for TU is Daniel Ball in Maryland. Daniel Ball in Maryland. So congratulations, Daniel. And also congratulations to Michael. I know you enjoy your memberships. Now, time to give away a copy of Bonefish Dreams, Stories, Facts, and Tips from Travels to the World's Best Destinations, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So you fill out the form on their homepage. You answer it there, put in your name, location, and see if you can't win Frank's book here. Frank mentioned, let's call it a universal fly used around the world for bonefish. What fly is that?
I would say the gotcha.
No, you're not supposed to answer. I know you know.
Well, I thought you were talking to me. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, now somebody knows the answer, and it looks like it's Treg Owings. And I think he had it already, but that's only happened three times in like 20 years to me. So I just get a kick out of it. I know my guest knows it. So, Treg, you know the routine, buddy. Send it on over and would get you a copy of this book, and I know you'll enjoy it. So now, Frank, thanks so much for being on my show tonight. It was a pleasure and interesting to hear you talk about bonefish, which are also a love of mine. I love the big three, bonefish, tarpon, and permit, and can't get enough of any of them. So it's always fun to talk about them.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It was a lot of fun.
Well, good, good, good. Well, hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link at the top line of our menu. In that archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 400 and some shows now. If you can search by keyword like bonefish, Bahamas, and you'll find shows I know you'll enjoy. Our next broadcast is July 1st, and that is going to be with Steve Ramirez. And I'm sorry, I just lost my screen here for a moment. Steve's got an upcoming book, and it's Travels to Patagonia. We're going to talk about his journey working through a lot of the fisheries in Central America and South America, and a lot of highlights from his upcoming book that will be released. I think it's in September. So join us for that on July 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll have fun talking with Steve again. I've interviewed him many times and love his books. He's a great writer. So hope to see you on that show. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Welcome.